Okay, so today we're going to talk about meaning, and thought at first I'd start with some sort of rationale for why I want to talk about meaning at all, what it's got to do with the middle way. And I mean, one immediate reason is my head is full of it because I just finished writing a book about it, but it is also, well, increasingly playing a part in my thinking, I think, as to how the middle way and middle way philosophy fits together. I mean, it was there from the beginning, but I think for a long time it was rather underspecified, but I mean, I've been giving it more attention recently. So why we need to discuss meaning? Well, to be able to understand how to justify our beliefs is one thing, or how beliefs are justified anyway, because beliefs are made out of meanings. So, in order to understand how the building is made, it's better to understand the bricks out of which it's constructed. And to integrate our desires, well, our desires are very, very often associated with meanings, with symbols which they're attached. So although we talked yesterday about desires in general, there's a whole dimension of that that we haven't really discussed yet, which is how those desires relate to symbols. So, for both those reasons, there's this interrelationship between meaning and belief and desire, and so it's a kind of sandwich, if you like, or perhaps more of a layer cake, anyway, something like that. So, I talk in terms of three levels of integration, and that's the structure of my Middle Way Philosophy series after the first volume, which is introducing the middle way in general, including the ethics. But after that, each of the volumes is volume 2 on desire, volume 3 on meaning, and volume 4 on belief. And each of those is focused on one of these levels of integration. So, it's crucial to the whole way I'm conceiving the way integration works, that so we can see it just in terms of desire as we did yesterday, but there were these other levels or these other dimensions of integration. So, also the order in which I'm tackling them now and the order in which I tackle them in my series of books is also deliberate. So I think it's best to understand them in that order. So starting with desire, moving on to meaning, moving on to belief. Because I think we need to understand meaning in terms of desire, rather than what traditionally people tend to do in Western thinking is to understand meaning in terms of belief. So I want to offer an alternative way of building up our model of it. And then once we've understood meaning, we need to understand belief in terms of that meaning. So, I mean, one basic way of thinking about that is beliefs are understood in terms of propositions, of sentences that claim something, but those sentences are made up of words or symbols of some description which have meanings. So that's why I'm suggesting that we need to build this up in that kind of way. So that's why I'm going on to more to belief tomorrow as the third stage of this process. But another particular reason for thinking about meaning is that meaning is, or the understanding of meaning is a false dichotomy. I think it's very often in the way it's treated in Western thinking. And there's a sort of series of linked false dichotomies associated with meaning. So separating reason from emotion, separating the sciences on the one hand from arts and religion on the other, and again that's linked to the reason and emotion dichotomy, facts and values similarly, and masculinity from femininity insofar as masculinity has often been associated with reason and femininity with emotion. So why I think there's a false dichotomy will perhaps become clearer as we go on, but you know, if you've ever felt that was the case, then I suppose part of what I'm trying to do is explaining why that's the case. So yeah, to start off with, then the limitations of cognitive and emotive approaches to reason, to meaning rather. So usually people think, when you talk about meaning, certainly academically, there are two recognised senses of the term meaning. So cognitive meaning and emotive meaning. So cognitive meaning, when you look at the meaning of a word in a dictionary, you're finding out its cognitive meaning. Okay. So you're finding out what that word represents, and obviously in a dictionary you're understanding it in terms of other symbols or words that you already understand. But basically, if you're finding an equivalent, that's helping you to get a sense of what the things are which you think are represented by the word concerned. Mm. Or if it's some other, if it's not a noun, if it's some other kind of word, like a preposition or a verb or whatever, again, you're trying to understand its function in sentences and how it fits into representations of the world. Mm. So cognitive meaning is overwhelmingly what's the concern of the sciences and the concern of philosophical analysis and the concern of linguistics. And then emotive meaning is, you know, sense of meaning when we talk about having a deep and meaningful experience, for example, that it's a depth or fulfillment found in experience.
And you say the meaning of life, is that?
Yes, that's an emotive, generally understood as an emotive, a question about emotive meaning. Okay. Yeah. So it really means something like, how will I get fulfillment from life? Mm-hmm. Rather than, what does the word life denote?
Yeah.
Which you could find out by looking it up in the dictionary. The dictionary won't tell you the meaning of life. In the emotive sense. Yeah, so cognitive meaning is traditionally linguistic. So it's only, we're only talking about words in terms of cognitive meaning. Propositional, so strictly speaking, according to analytic philosophers, the units of cognitive meaning are sentences, and not just any old sentence, but a proposition, so a sentence that claims something. So the cat sat on the mat, Paris is the capital of France. You know, these are sentences which claim something about the world or about, you know, some sort of state of affairs. So the meaning for an analytic philosopher, the cognitive meaning of the cat sat on the mat, is dependent on the truth or falsity of whether the cat is in fact sitting on the mat. So you understand the meaning of the sentence when you understand the conditions in which it will be true or false. That's the sort of traditional analytic definition of cognitive meaning. So it's also representational, so that there's some kind of picture or idea in the mind which is said to represent something beyond the mind. Wittgenstein talked in terms of the picture theory of meaning, which is one rough way of getting to grips with it. So you've got something in your mind which is said to be equivalent to or map onto something outside the mind, and that's, again, the traditional way of thinking about cognitive meaning. And in terms of the dichotomy found in most Western thinking, that cognitive meaning is separating from the opposites in emotive meaning. So emotive meaning is aesthetic. It's obviously to do with how we feel in the broadest sense of the term, and what our direct experience is through the senses. It's irrational in the sense that it's considered to be not subject to judgments that can be verified and checked upon and so on. Not subject to reasoning. And it's said to be subjective. So all that's just to clarify that kind of traditional picture, which I'm obviously going to disagree with. But so in practice, I want to argue that cognitive and emotive meaning are never separated. Obviously, you can analyse them separately, which is what people have been doing since Plato. But the fact that we can abstract them and think about them distinctly doesn't mean that we actually experience them separately. So in practice, whenever there's some sort of cognitive claim, that cognitive claim is only meaningful if there's something in it which grabs our interest, if there's some emotive aspects to it. My favourite example to illustrate that point, I think, is the safety announcements when you get on a flight. So you can, at least when you've done a few flights, obviously not your first flight when it's all new and interesting, but by the time you get to your 10th flight or whatever, and you're sitting there and they're about to, they go through these safety announcements, and you know, how much does it actually mean? Personally, by about my 10th flight, I'd completely lost interest in this sort of routine bureaucratic language. So it's not that I didn't understand the safety announcements. I understood what those words were meant to denote. But since I had no interest in them, actually, the words and propositions of the safety announcement were not really penetrating my mind at all, because they weren't grabbing my attention. Without emotive meaning, cognitive claims are nowhere, because we're flesh and blood creatures with desires that have to be motivated to take anything in. We have to have our attention directed, which is why emotive meaning is important to us. But at the same time, we can't have purely emotive symbols either, that they always represent something to some extent. So you could take any kind of symbol that seems meaningful to us, and you can ascribe some sort of cognitive meaning to it. Now, obviously, that becomes a harder, perhaps sort of attenuated process, a more difficult process if you're talking about, I know, an E flat on the piano, or the wail of a baby, or something like this. Could be seen as meaningful symbols. What does an E flat on the piano mean? Well, I've just called it an E flat on the piano, so it does mean something. It might have associations for me, but if nothing else, it's got this place within a musical schema in my mind.
Could you define symbol?
A symbol, in the way I'm using it anyway, is... I'll give my definition later on, actually, on the second page, but that it's some sort of, I was going to say representation, that's the wrong way of putting it, some sort of object, let's say, to make it as well as possible,
okay.
An object which is associated with a set of desires that are recalled to us by that object. In a repeatable fashion. Yeah, so for it to start to be symbolic, usually we'd have to at least come back to it a second time and recognise that meaning from how it was before.
So that baby's wail.
But I recognise the baby's wail as indicating the baby needs attention.
Yeah.
So if it indicates something for me, then it's got some sort of cognitive meaning.
And the E flat?
D flat is telling me the piano is slightly out of tune, or it's telling me that piece of music is progressing a little bit further, or it's telling me that it's half a tone below E or whatever.
But that's information rather than desire, isn't it? Oh, sorry.
Yes, it is. But what I was suggesting is that the information and the desire, although we can analyse them separately, are interlinked in a way that they cannot, in fact, in our flesh and blood existence, be separated.
Yeah.
So, therefore, I'm suggesting if we want to understand meaning in a way that's adequate to our flesh and blood existence, we need to think of them together rather than just separately. This all links in with some of the stuff we were talking about yesterday about brains and the cognitive versus emotive division seems to reflect the left versus right brain, right hemisphere function. In that, obviously, the left hemisphere is concerned with cognitive meanings, so it assembles a representation of the world for a purpose, as we were saying yesterday. So cognitive meaning is placed within what we would call a cognitive model, in a representation of what we think is real at that point. So any meaning appreciated by the left hemisphere is going to be cognitive meaning, in terms ultimately of the purposes of the left hemisphere. But right brain meaning must be much more intuitive, related to whole experience. Part of our holistic response to our environment. So I think to integrate the functions of the hemispheres, an integrated understanding of meaning should help. Particularly if we can apply it, of course, not just in theory, but we have to look at it in theory first.
When you first started, I was thinking, but is he talking about meaning as in that word means that, or as in how the meaning of life? And I was like, should I ask? And then when you said it's both, I kind of went. And just as you explained it, it kind of made more and more sense. And so that's really, like you said, you had a bit of a ding moment yesterday. So that was that for me today. I was like, they're not completely separate, because I have always thought of them as completely separate. And I have, you know, since the Gaia House meditation, I've been a lot more thinking about the meaning of life and the point of my existence and stuff like that. So I've been thinking of the word meaning in the emotive sense, as opposed to previously as a language teacher, where you just think of it in the representational sense. That was really interesting. I've had loads of thoughts and some questions. I don't know about going through all of them. One was, I heard a story of this guy who was studying in the jungle, I think he was studying the monkeys' sounds that they made, and they made different calls for different predators. And that's obviously a very primitive, you know, it's language, basically, I guess. I don't know whether that fits the definition. But it was interesting because he said that when he'd finished his study and he was walking back to the camp, and he heard the monkey make the sound for leopard, and he went, oh my God, there's a leopard. And it was, you know, and he was said it was a really interesting moment of, you know, they weren't talking to him, but, you know, he was part of the jungle in that moment. And the other animals understood the monkeys' calls as well. And they knew where, and they were still, 'cause they knew whether they looked up or down. So when the monkeys made a particular noise that they thought meant eagle, they all looked up and, you know. So that was, I think there's something interesting that made me think of that.
Is that Robert Seyfarth?
Could be. Don't remember names. When you said something about the representation is the dominant one in society, I definitely felt that instinctively. But then I started wondering, is that definitely true, or is it just that the emotive representation is really difficult to talk about? And it's really difficult to write about. So maybe it's just not something that we communicate. Maybe it's very strong in us. You just don't hear, you know, you don't know that other people are thinking about it.
Yeah, but also it's not taken seriously related to that. And I think there's something feminists might relate to that. This traditional idea that women talk about feelings and they're not really meaningful in the strict sense.
And then... say a couple more if I haven't
Yeah.
With